to live righteously.
Hey, it's me, Richie T, and it is episode 102 of the Cultural Hall. I promise not a large rambling.
Yeah, we won't give you a lot of stuff to listen to, so you can get right to the meat and potatoes of this podcast.
I like to think of the meat more than the potatoes to make it scriptural.
Oh, okay.
This is the milk.
The milk.
Yeah, right now, the milk before meat.
Oh, okay.
I don't know, scriptural, something.
So what's this podcast?
Well, coming up, people are going to enjoy their questions about Mormon history answered. A few weeks ago on our Facebook page, The Cultural Hall on Facebook.
Was this with your Mormon History Guy?
Yeah, it's mormonhistoryguy.com. We took the questions that you had.
Oh, good.
And not you, Rob.
No, oh, okay.
And right. Not me, Richie.
Right.
But questions that people had, and even some of the harder questions.
Oh, right.
And we said, what about this Mormon History Guy?
And he answers them?
And he answers them. So that's coming up in the second and the third book.
Very good.
And it's random.
Random.
It is as random as there are different listeners to The Cultural Hall. Yeah. There is one person that's like, well, I heard that, and then there's someone else who's just like, is it Ensign or Ensign?
Oh, okay.
So
Ensign's from Star Trek,
right? But again, if you look in the very front of the Ensign magazine from the church, or mm-hmm. Ensign magazine, it can be pronounced both ways.
Ooh.
Like, it's like the church knows that there have been countless arguments about how to pronounce it, and so they finally just said, you know what? It can be both. Let's have it
okay.
be both.
Okay, there you go.
So, that's coming up in the second and third block. Remind everyone they can leave a review for us on iTunes.
Yes.
You can find us on Stitcher.
Yes.
And listen there. That's a great app you can get on your phone.
Leave your comments on our Cultural Hall page.
Yeah, if there's something in particular about an episode that you didn't like, we'd love to hear about that. And if there's something that you did like.
We'd like to hear the stuff that you do like sometimes.
Yeah, it helps gear where we're going in the future with various guests.
Constructive
and stuff
criticism like Rob not speaking up and his microphone keeps cutting out.
Right.
Things like that.
That's a good one.
I've stopped wearing my headphones because of that.
Yeah, because before you were...
I would listen to myself talk. Mm-hmm. If I don't listen to the way I talk, then I just speak better.
Yeah.
Anyway.
There was a really cool thing, and then that really cool thing went away. I should mention that real quick.
What was that?
I had one of the guys from the First Presidency. From the First Quorum of the 70,
yes.
Agreed to do the Cultural Hall.
Yes.
Because he has authored a book.
Yes.
And then he found out that he couldn't do it, but I had an interview scheduled.
No.
And I was like, as soon as the press person contacted me, I'm like, yes, let's do it as soon as possible, because I knew that it was going to back out.
The person I really want to get is Marlon Kane Jensen,
yes.
Who was the church
but he's
historian.
He's emeritus, so we could probably get him.
Yeah, and he's a lawyer. He's gone back to his law practice. I think he lives up in Logan.
Mm-hmm.
He's one guy on my radar that would be great.
Okay, get him.
So, I don't know him personally, but we can see what we can do.
He's a law firm.
What about
DJing for a bunch of law firms.
Yeah.
Let's get Marlon K. Jensen. Is he one of the Jensens of Jensen and Jensen and Jensen?
I don't know.
And Jensen?
I think he's up in Logan, though.
And Jensen?
And Jensen.
And Jensen.
One call, that's all. But, you know, or we could get the guy that did my wedding.
Yeah, that'd be cool. You didn't even mention that.
Yeah.
That was cool.
Richard Hinckley.
Yeah.
A.K.A. Dick.
Yeah, President.
Do you know what his wife's name is? Guess. Dick and...
K.
Dick and...
I don't know.
Dick and Jane.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. Isn't that fun?
Rob was sealed. That was cool. In the Salt Lake Temple by...
Richard Hinckley.
Who is Gordon B. Hinckley's son.
And he made a mention... He gave a nod to his dad.
Yeah.
He said, my father said this.
Yeah, I thought that was way cool.
Yeah.
And he looked so much like him.
Yeah.
I was, as I, you know, came in seemingly pretty late to your temple ceiling. And
yeah, that was funny. Richie comes down the hall and we see him and he's like,
well, because it was very much one of those moments, and I only have a second here, but it was very much one of those moments where I said, I told Rob I would be here.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of times that I'm not a very good friend. I'm sort of a crummy friend.
Oh, no.
A little bit. You know, it's like, hey, you asked me to give a toast, and I couldn't be there because I was filming a movie. And that's a little bit lousy. Maybe I should have not gone and done the movie. I should have been there for the toast for my best friend. Though with how many toasts it sounded like you had, I wasn't interested
in
being
there.
Yeah,
he wasn't missed.
I said, you know what? I'm going to be there. And I'm running downtown Salt Lake and running through lights and stuff
and then,
like that.
And then, you know, putting on a tie as you're heading into the temple. Because I had to leave a tie for you.
But at least you
made it.
Yeah, I made it.
Cool.
And it was cool to hear, is it Elder Hinckley still? He would be an Elder Hinckley.
He would be an elder.
Because he was part of the 70 too, right?
Yeah. So once an elder, always an elder.
Yeah, Elder Hinckley here at the temple ceiling. So that was cool.
So yeah, any other suggestions of general authorities, emeritus, who you think? think would be a good candidate for the Culture Hall, let us know.
Yeah, or guests just in general. We'd love to have them. And now that my hearing is starting to come back, perhaps I'll be able to hear the things that they say to me.
Oh, very good.
It's life-of-the-party.com if you want Rob to come to your
Christmas party
or entertain you as far as that goes.
Or
let's get
wedding.
Into the second and third and your weddings. Do people get married over Christmas?
Sure.
Not as much.
But we need to book our New Year's Eve. Do you want to work New Year's Eve?
Maybe. For the right amount of money, I will.
Yeah.
Last year was great.
You can do get Richie T for your New Year's Eve wedding or New Year's Eve party.
Last year was great.
Yeah. And people loved it.
Let's get the second and third block of the Cultural Hall. It's Mormon History Guy answering your Mormon history questions.
Running a small business today can be difficult enough. Imagine all the work you have to do to market it. Imagine the hours you put in to create promotional materials for it. Now, imagine a partner that can help you with all of that and more. Imagine Lennon Design. Lennon Design is your partner in business when you need a professional look at a price you can afford. Whether it's websites, advertising media, promotional materials, and more, Lennon Design can help you promote your business. When you need creative, affordable designs, let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
Hey, it's me, Richie T. It's the second block here of the Cultural Hall, and on the phone with me right now from it's Wyoming. It's Star Valley, Wyoming, and it's Russell Stevens. It's the Mormon History Guy. Thanks for being here with me.
Hey, good to be back with you, Richie.
Loving what you're doing on our Facebook page with posting the history facts of the day, and it seems like everyone else is really enjoying it, so thank you for doing that.
It's been a fun experience.
How's everything over at Mormon HistoryGuy.com going pretty well?
You know, it is going pretty well. What I really have been trying to do with that blog is, you know, approach Mormon history from novel ways, in ways we don't normally think about Mormon history. For example, you know, I try to talk about, you know, the history of male objectification in Mormon culture, and you know, that's not something that we typically think of. You know, most people who talk about objectification at all in Mormon history, it tends to be talking about, you know, men projecting that onto women, and of course, you know, my essay doesn't suppose that doesn't happen, but I do suggest that, you know, maybe there has been some level of reciprocity. So I like turning people on their head, and even if just momentarily.
Mm-hmm. There have been some people who said, "What kind of blog? Oh, is this the Cultural Hall just a wolf in sheep's clothing?" And it's like, come on.
I've met wolves in sheep's clothing, and if you're a wolf in sheep's clothing, Richie, you're doing a really bad job of it, and you should be fired. So, the Cultural Hall has been everyone I talk to, they all acknowledge that, you know, it is by far one of the more moderate voices they hear when it comes to Mormonism.
Well, good. I like the sound of that. We brought in Russell because we want him to just answer questions. We posted on our Facebook page. Do you have any questions about Mormon history, and that way we could just answer questions that people had. I think that this relationship will continue to grow as various projects come about, both for us here in the Cultural Hall and for Russell in his work. So we posted on our Facebook page, what questions do people have? And I'm ready to just dive in. Does that sound all right?
Let's do it.
All right. So I want to start here. Let's start it a little bit soft. Rob Winder asked, in Lucy Mack Smith's biography of her son, she gives an account of a dream that Joseph Sr. had that is very similar to Lehi's Tree of Life vision. Are there any other recorded accounts of his dream besides Mother Smith's?
You know, that's a fascinating question, and it's something that's come up in, you know, biographies of the Smith family for some time. It's important that we understand, though, you know, the exact source, you know, for, you know, this story. Lucy Mack Smith, you know, was obviously, as with most mothers, you know, very, you know, enamored with her own family. You know, she loved her husband, she loved her children. You know, she really believed in, you know, the Smith and Mack family names. And in the early 1850s, she produced a volume with the assistance of Howard and Martha Corey. That basically was a history of her son as well as of the Smith family. And in the early parts of this, she tells us that Joseph Smith Sr. had experienced a vision in which he was or a dream rather, that in which he was kind of walking through the wilderness, and then suddenly he comes upon a tree, and you know, any time he's about to partake of the fruit of this tree, you know, he wakes up. Now, for believing Latter-day Saints, or even Latter-day, or even anyone familiar with the Book of Mormon, you hear that and you say, well, that sounds pretty similar to 1 Nephi chapter 8, or 1 Nephi chapters 11 through 14 in some way or another. But if you're going to, you know, look at the original source, or at least the earliest source, I mean, the Book of Mormon provides us the earlier source. And then it was Lucy Mack Smith who began talking about it several years after the fact. Now, some scholars, such as Richard Bushman, have suggested that, you know, Lucy Mack Smith wanted to read into her own past in an effort to show continuity between father and son.
Hmm.
You know, that Joseph Smith Sr. was preparing the way for Joseph Smith Jr. And I do think it's interesting that Lucy's younger son, William, you know, he started his own church towards the late 1840s, became a bitter critic of the Brighamites in Utah, and claimed that, you know, he had the prophetic mantle, that he had inherited it from Joseph Smith. And in all of his writings, he does not draw upon this vision at all. You know, he says that, you know, the Smith family name does have a kind of special place in Gog's kingdom, and that they are, you know, by nature of their heritage, you know, fit to rule over a church. And he uses the Book of Mormon to justify this, but at no time does he mention that there was any kind of continuity between him and his father through, you know, these visionary experiences.
All right. So that's one question down. Hopefully, Rob, that suffices. But he has a couple other questions. So while we're on the topic of what Rob wants to know, let's do another one. In By the Hand of Mormon by Terrell Givens, it notes that the Book of Mormon was very seldom used in the elders' early preaching. And this was even true with Joseph himself. The mere existence of the Book of Mormon was much more important than its content. The question, first of all, I would be curious to know is that in fact true? And then his question is when did it start to change that we taught more from the Book of Mormon?
That's also an excellent question. And I do like that you added the question whether that is in fact true or not. I have tremendous respect for Terrell Givens. You know, he's something of a rock star in the world of Mormon studies. However, I would push back against that thesis, you know, ever so slightly. You know, it's true that the Latter-day Saints drew from the Bible much more freely than they drew from the Book of Mormon. The Bible was what they knew. I mean, the Bible was considered to be the literary cornerstone of, you know, much of American society in antebellum America. So it's reasonable that, and really predictable, that they would, you know, use the Bible quite freely in their preaching. The Book of Mormon, on the other hand, while it was valued, it was still new material. So, you know, they wouldn't be as conversant in it as they were with the Bible. You know, in the earliest periodicals of the church, though, you know, we do see people like W.W. Phelps and Joseph Smith, to some extent, referencing Book of Mormon passages. You know, they print entire parts of the Book of Mormon in those newspapers. Joseph Smith would quote from the Book of Almonds in some of his preaching, as would Joseph Smith's mother. So I think we characterize it a little bit if we say that the Book of Mormon had really no role, you know, in early preaching based on the substance of the book. You know, it wasn't just that this book exists. There was actually material in the book that Latter-day Saints did find to be inspirational. But that being said, I do think that there is some foundation for this question. You know, you look in the Doctrine and Covenants, and the Lord says, you know, you have basically taken lightly my new covenant, which is the Book of Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Joseph Smith would not have, you know, given voice to these ideas unless the Latter-day Saints had been failing to take into account the Book of Mormon as they ought to have been, at least according to Joseph's own standards. And, you know, we know that Brigham Young, he wasn't really much of a bookish person anyway. While he had been raised in the Bible, you know, he wasn't a heavy reader. He wasn't much of a theologian. So I would be surprised if I were to see Brigham Young, you know, cite the Book of Mormon that much. It just hadn't been part of his world. Reading hadn't been really that much part of his world. So I would suggest that, you know, we really begin to see use of the Book of Mormon taper off as we enter the Utah period. And it really doesn't come back to life, at least with the same level of force, until Ezra Taft Benson.
It was
always there in the background. It was always there in the wings. And you know, Latter-day Saints always valued the Book of Mormon's place in the Restoration narrative, but actually looking to it for theology making, it hasn't been, you know, a major part of the Mormon approach to religion.
All the way until Ezra Taft Benson, you would say, which is like what? It's mid-80s. Is that right?
Yes. You know,
mid-1980s?
It's Ezra Taft Benson who was, you know, really talking about flooding the earth with the Book of Mormon. And, you know, you see some things with Spencer W. Kimball, too, because he's talking about how he hopes that scenes from the Book of Mormon will eventually, you know, make it into art and make it into film, and you know, that we'll begin celebrating it. And, you know, how we could at some point hope to maybe have, you know, our own Mormon artists, you know, giving life to this. And Ezra Taft Benson echoes these views as well. So, you know, you're looking at something on the order of 120, 130 years.
Okay, and then last question from Rob. I promise all the questions aren't from Rob, but his last question is there anything in Martin Harris's life prior to his encounter with Joseph and the Gold Bible, his quotes, to suggest that he was particularly gullible?
You know, Martin Harris, he's a complex figure, because on the one hand, you know, he had been raised in the Puritan world of New England. And, you know, for New England Puritans, providence was a major part of, you know, of how they saw the relationship with God. Providence basically means that, you know, God has an immediate and intervening hand in one's life. And, you know, this theological worldview, you know, endured through, you know, rural America throughout the 18th century and even into the 19th century. You know, the intellectuals in the 18th century, they had basically given this up, and they were beginning to, you know, see the world less as a providential one and more as, you know, a kind of a clock that, you know, this distant clockmaker had made at one point and then just, you know, let go on its own. But Martin Harris, you know, he still believed in providence. So you do see some evidence that, you know, he would ascribe, you know, miraculous causes to things. He certainly was willing to accept the idea of a village seer, you know, that there was a local, you know, young man of some kind who could use a stone or some kind of amulet to find lost objects. You do find evidence of that. But I think it's also easy to overstate, you know, the degree of his gullibility. You know, you look at his earliest interactions with Joseph Smith, and, you know, what is one of the first things that Martin wants before he invests money into the project? He wants to go see learned professors in New York City, and, you know, people like Charles Anthon, Sam Mitchell. Now, if he were that gullible, he would not have, you know, gone to that tremendous effort and really personal. He wouldn't have spent those kinds of personal resources to find out whether this book were true. He would have basically taken Joseph at his word. So I do think that we see Martin Harris as being somewhat vulnerable to, you know, supernatural explanations, but not so much so that, you know, he gives up all semblance of critical thought.
All right. Sorry. There we go. I had to click through. Let me go here. I thought this was an interesting question. This one is from a woman named Maravik Ruiz. Her question: if the Book of Mormon is the most correct translation, why has it been rewritten and had names changed from one person to another? Why were some verses taken away? Why the change if it is supposedly the most correct? Even the part about it written by Joseph Smith was changed to translated by Joseph Smith. Correct me if I'm wrong. And why were names in the book similar to the names of actual places and areas Joseph Smith lived in? Why did he preach against polygamy yet practice it himself? So a lot of questions.
Yeah, there are a lot of questions packed in there. And in fairness, in transparency, I'm probably going to leave off the polygamy question just because, you know, that is its own podcast.
Yeah.
Now, there's no way I could really give fair treatment to that question, you know, in this answer. But the other questions, it definitely bears some level of discussion. So she made a comment about how some of the names were changed in the Book of Mormon, and, you know, how you see a number of changes, you know, over the course of the Book of Mormon's history, and people have counted it up, and once you counted all the grammatical changes, all the spelling changes, everything, you have something on the order of 3,000 changes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for people who come to the Book of Mormon with a certain set of assumptions about how Scripture ought to be, then yes, that would be troubling, you know, especially if, you know, you adopt this inerrantist perspective of evangelical Christians. You know, the idea that the written word is somehow more sacred and more hallowed than oral traditions. If you see scripture that way, then this would be quite troubling. But that really isn't how Joseph Smith saw scripture or even how he saw language. We see Joseph Smith really playing fast and loose with the meanings of words. From my perspective, in Joseph Smith's mind, language was fluid. He saw language as stifling, and he called it a prison once. Hmm. And it was a prison that he constantly felt the need to escape. He developed something of an obsession with, you know, getting at the pure language, the original language. So I think you can put the translation of the Book of Mormon, you know, into this broader narrative arc. It really started Joseph Smith's obsession with learning what or how God wanted us to express ourselves. So really, it's no surprise that he would have refined certain things over the course of several years, because that would, you know, Joseph Smith didn't see language as being something that was pure at all. It was at best an imperfect medium, and it was one that the Lord constantly wanted him to, you know, to work on, to refine, to mold, to get it just right. Now, she does mention something about changing names, and I do think that's a different animal than what we were talking about. Just to use one example, in Mosiah chapter 21, verse 28, there was a reference to Benjamin in the original manuscript and the printer's manuscript of the Book of Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
And in subsequent editions, this name was changed to Mosiah. Now, the context here is important. You know, Ammon, you know, who was one of the early missionaries in the Book of Mormon, he's talking about who is in charge of the records. You know, was it King Benjamin the father or King Mosiah the son?
Hmm.
And this is a rather strange change. You're like, well, wait a minute. It's one thing to talk about changing phrasing or, you know, maybe changing grammar or other things, but now we're talking about the identity of a person. Why didn't Joseph get that right?
Right.
And what, you know, if you're going to answer this question from a faithful perspective, you need to start at least attempting to see the Book of Mormon as an historical document, as a document that has a number of narratives, that has, you know, competing narratives, overlapping narratives. You know, sometimes it flashes back. Sometimes you have two different stories or two different accounts telling the same story. So in this case, you know, you've got Mosiah 21:28 saying this, but then you look at Mosiah chapter 8, verses 13 and 14. Now, Mosiah chapter 8, verses 13 and 14, it's different from Mosiah 21:28, because 21:28 is a narrative account, you know, written after the fact. It doesn't offer primary sources. It doesn't offer an original quote. Mosiah 8, 13, and 14, though, it directly quotes Ammon. And in that quotation, Ammon doesn't even make reference to the name of the king. He just says, I can tell thee of a king, you know, who can interpret records and is in charge of the archives. So what we see here is that you could easily make the argument that Mosiah 21:28, which is an after-the-fact account, was simply incorrect. Whatever scribe was taking that down made a mistake. That happens.
Mm-hmm.
And you could argue that, you know, in the original record, it's ambiguous as to who, you know, the verse should have been referring to. So Joseph Smith comes along, and he is charged with translating it. And if there's something that's, you know, ambiguous, and especially if it's something that isn't of tremendous significance, I could easily see, you know, a human element playing into the translation process. I mean, in the Book of Mormon itself, we see warnings that this book is an erroneous book at times. It says, if there are errors, there be errors of men. And I would say that exhibits a tremendous degree of self-consciousness about the volume's own imperfections.
Yeah, which is what I was going to point out is that though the tagline, the byline of the whole thing is the most correct of any book, but that doesn't mean that it's 100% correct.
Right. You know, we could look at it, you know, from other perspectives as well. You know, you look at the relationship between the Nephites and the Lamanites, right? And it's typically in that relationship where you see the most racist comments in all of the volume. You know, they talk about them being filthy and loathsome, and largely due to, you know, the darkness of their skin, or at least the darkness of their skin is associated with their sinfulness. And I look at that and I say, well, you know, you could argue that that's a product of racism in the 19th century, or if you wanted to view it from a faith perspective, you could say that the Nephites were simply committing the sin of racism.
Hmm.
And we shouldn't expect Nephite prophets or Nephite societies to be, you know, exemplars of virtue and morality. There are several occasions where we don't, where, you know, the Lamanites are called upon to preach to the Nephites and call them to repentance.
Hmm. All right. Well, let's come back in the third block here and we'll answer some more questions. Questions including a little bit about the actual translation of the Book of Mormon and how it's taught within the LDS Church. And then also whether or not we feel like the church glosses over some not so flattering history. That's coming back in the third block of the Cultural Hall.
Sidewinder Media was named as one of Utah's top photographers by In This Week magazine and is a winner of several awards for fine art, portrait, and event photography. Sidewinder Media has been professionally photographing everything from wildlife to headshots for over 10 years. Sidewinder Media has the experience and the knowledge to capture your special occasion or portrait the way you want it. They also film and edit music or product videos and do simple ads for Facebook or websites. Email them at sidewindermedia@gmail.com or call Rusty at 801-941-5576 to book your shoot today.
All right. Hey, it's me, Richie T. It's the third block of the Cultural Hall. It's Russell Stevenson, MormonHistoryGuy.com. If you want to find out more about him. In the break, he asked me if I feel like this is going well, and I think it's going really well. And I appreciate you taking time and also researching into some of these questions so that we can deliver answers to people. I also like how at several points within the interview so far, you've said, you know, from a faith promoting or from a believing standpoint, you have to, you know, the explanation of it that way. So I appreciate that.
Hey, no problem. You know, I try to please as many of your listeners as possible, and I understand that you have quite the diverse listenership.
Yes, for sure. There was one other question in Maravich's question that we didn't get to. What do you think about the part where it says written by Joseph Smith and then translated by Joseph Smith, and then we'll move on?
Right, you know, I was just thinking about that, so I'm glad that you mentioned that again. So in order to understand this, you need to understand a little bit about, you know, the laws surrounding the publishing of the Book of Mormon. You know, really, we're not talking about, you know, whether Joseph Smith believed he wrote it or not. We're talking about, you know, copyright issues. So according to a 1790 federal statute, the individuals who would be given copyright to books were, quote, authors or proprietors, unquote. So when Joseph Smith identified himself as an author in the 1830 Book of Mormon, he was doing so in accordance with the federal statute of the time. He wasn't making a statement about, you know, the nature of the volume. He was just playing by the rules of the time. You know, this is what the law said he needed to do in order to really obtain a copyright. You're calling yourself a translator, you know, that introduced some legal ambiguity. You know, could you have copyright? Would you not? It may have been a topic for litigation. And this was not an abstract fear Joseph Smith harbored either. You know, he would have individuals who would attempt to steal portions of the Book of Mormon and then publish them in their own papers. So I would suggest that, you know, it just came down to, you know, using the language of the day in order to, you know, get the job at hand done.
All right, so let's go to the next question then. This one is from, where do I want to go with this? This is from Todd Johnson. His question, why was I taught that Joseph Smith translated the Book of Mormon from gold plates when he actually wrote the Book of Mormon without the plates even being in the room? I've heard that he often translated the Book of Mormon with his head in a hat, looking at seer stones. Is there any truth to that? And the thing that I would add to that is that I know that there's some truth to that, and why did I find out about it on South Park?
Very, very astute point, Richie. You know, as I was talking with the Barker brothers once, and they were planning a post where they said, why is South Park telling better Mormon history than Mormons do? You know, this is problematic.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, my point isn't to get into that, at least at this stage. But, you know, this issue of translation, you know, it does, you know, pose certain issues for the narrative that many of us have been raised with. So I don't know why this inquirer was taught the way he was. I wasn't in his community. I wasn't in his family, so I couldn't answer that. But I can say that there is some truth to what he's saying, and there's also some things that could bear some revision. First, the truth. So it is indeed true that there is limited evidence, if any, that Joseph Smith used the plates in the translation process. We do know that at one point, you know, he looked at the plates because, you know, both he and his wife drew up some characters that would be taken to Charles Anthon in New York City. So he looked at the plates at that point. So it wasn't like he never looked at them. And furthermore, there is very good evidence that Joseph Smith did, during a significant part of the translation process, use what was called a seer stone to assist him. Now, a seer stone, it was basically, like for most of us, we would just see it as a rock,
mm-hmm.
right? But when you're living in agrarian upstate New York, and when you're living in a world where you're feeling a little bit disaffected from traditional religion, yeah, you believe in the Bible, but you know, you've had this or that pastor treat you poorly, that you feel like they teach false doctrine, you feel like it's all man-made, you're more inclined to look towards the natural world for your religion. And this, you know, the use of a seer stone was not unheard of within Joseph Smith's rural communities, especially those individuals who, again, felt themselves disaffected, who didn't feel like institutionalized religion represented them. So Joseph Smith turned to Mother Earth, you might say, and you know, part of this discourse, and you know, part of this culture was the use of things that Mother Earth gave you. And for the way this ended up translating Joseph Smith's mind was that a seer stone could reveal to you, you know, the mysteries of the kingdom, or even reveal something to you as banal as as a lost object. So during the translation process, what happened was Joseph Smith did indeed put a stone in a hat, and that's a strange image, but from Joseph Smith's perspective, this was in order to kind of create a dark aura through which the light of the stone could shine through.
Hmm.
I know this sounds all very science fiction-y, right? It does sound a little bit more mystical than we 21st century people like to think of it as being. But for Joseph Smith's culture and Joseph Smith's time, this was not entirely strange. It did fit within a certain discourse. Now, there were individuals within his community, especially those who called themselves educated or who were well-established. You know, they did think it was a lot of hocus-pocus, as many of us do. But ultimately, I would say this was a class division. This was a division between the wealthy and the poor. When you have someone who has a seer stone, and they're going off and searching for lost treasures with this stone, it's something that you think is a little bit weird if you've got a good business or you've got a good farm that is productive. But if you're like the Smith family and you're just renters, you're economically vulnerable, you're looking to anything to try to make a buck, to hope that you can make the next payment, well, yeah, you end up turning to things that the wealthy would not turn to. And it makes sense that this sort of practice would seep its way into how Joseph Smith saw the translation process.
Speculate. Why do you think we don't talk about it?
I think we don't talk about it primarily because it was really a different world that we live in. It was a different world that they lived in. It's a different culture, a different way of seeing things. It's so different for us now that we hear it and it just sends off all the weird, weird alarms, right? Oh, wow, that's just so different. How could God ever work through something so different, so strange?
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is that, from the faithful perspective, God works within the culture in which you live. God meets you where you are. And I don't know why we should see the Joseph Smith experience as being anything different. Now, in fairness to Joseph, in later years, and even in some years around the time of the Book of Mormon, he was fairly self-conscious of his use of seer stones and his relationship to those who use seer stones. During his 1838 history, he came out and said that that he had committed sins during this time period. That the use of seer stones, his association with the money diggers, as they were called, it was an embarrassment to him.
Hmm.
And he would never forget this. And he would time after time say that that was a part of his past, and that we should all just get over it.
I got another question that I want to ask you. This, again, from the Facebook page. You can find us on Facebook. It's The Cultural Hall on Facebook, which is appropriate because, well, that's the name of this podcast. Well, let's see. Are you familiar with Nutty Mormon History? If you are, would you consider that series more accurate than not? Or is it just some Mormon third-hand stories that actually do not have a basis? This is from Carlos Palomo.
You know, I try to do a little bit of research into the Nutty Mormon History series. I mean, in my research consisted of a Google search. And nothing came up that resembled what he said in the posts. So I'm going to have to say that I'm not familiar with Nutty Mormon History, and I'm afraid I can't answer that question.
Okay, well, that's easy enough. Let's then, Carlos, send us some more information so we know what we're talking about, or we know what you're talking about.
Send us more information, and I'll be happy to engage it.
This question from Jonathan Goff. Are there any records on how far into the 20th century that polygamous marriages existed after the ban on them?
Yeah, this question really has a couple questions packed into it. The first question is, how long was polygamy allowed within the Mormon community? And, you know, you could say that it was officially allowed as late as 1904. Now, we typically think of, you know, the year 1890 as being, you know, the end of polygamy in the Mormon community.
Mm-hmm.
But that really isn't the full story. In order for us to understand the significance of, you know, the 1890 termination of polygamy, and I really should put termination in quotation marks, is we need to understand the Latter-day Saints were under siege, you know, from fairly powerful federal authorities. It looked like they were going to basically lose all of their holdings, including the temple. So when you get people backed into a corner, you know, they end up doing things, you know, just to, you know, have some semblance of freedom and to get you off their back. So the first presidency and, you know, the Quorum of the Twelve, or at least the better portion of them, agreed upon a manifesto in which they said that, you know, polygamy would no longer be practiced in the Mormon community. But you can't kill a social system overnight, right? You can't just say, all right, we're not doing polygamy anymore. Well, you know, here you have all these polygamous families, and you have wives who are dependent upon their husbands, you know, for some kind of sustenance.
Yep. Nope. And we're done. It has to end right now. Overnight. Done. That's it. No more.
Yeah. That's just not feasible. So, you know, polygamy did endure after 1890, and there were polygamous marriages contracted after 1890. Because the idea being that, okay, the federal authorities have put us into a corner, so we need to get them off our back until we can, you know, really, you know, get over this practice. Polygamous marriages did drop precipitously after 1890. So it's not like church leaders just brazenly began to do it in the face of federal authorities. Rather, it was a tapering off. Now, I've heard it compared to a faucet. You know, when you turn off the water, right, there's probably going to be a couple drips.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to keep going a little bit. And then it was finally in 1904 during the Reed-Smoot hearings. Reed-Smoot, you know, he was a senator elected to the United States Senate from Utah, and people questioned his loyalty to America. You know, could he be a good senator and a good Mormon at the same time, given this polygamous, you know, the polygamy of his society? And within this context, the church leadership finally said, okay, we are officially distancing ourselves from polygamy. Okay, so we've been talking about the official responses. Now we need to start talking about, you know, what's happening behind the scenes, sometimes, you know, from church leaders who, you know, had their own agendas. We have evidence that some level of polygamy did endure among certain Latter-day Saints, you know, as late as the 1920s. And, you know, this is where you really see the rise of the fundamentalist Latter-day Saints. You know, people like Lauren Woolley, Joseph Musser, they both practiced polygamy in the 1910s. You know, with Joseph Musser in particular, he's interesting because he had friends in high places, and mm-hmm. they basically allowed his polygamy to slide under the radar. And when it was discovered that he was practicing polygamy, he was disfellowshipped, so there was some level of disciplinary action. But he was also sent on a mission to India.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. So what you end up seeing happening is, you know, on the one hand, they acknowledge it was wrong, it was bad, but on the other hand, they recognize that those who were practicing polygamy had been, by all accounts, good Latter-day Saints.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of tried to have it both ways, and I can understand why they did, Because remember, a lot of Latter-day Saints, they still didn't see polygamy as a bad thing. I mean, these days, we tend to see polygamy as, okay, well, it's a tolerable thing. I get why they did it, but, oh, you know, we would never want to live
it. Yeah, not today.
At this stage in Latter-day Saint history, it was seen as, okay, you know, we were put in a corner. This is what had to happen for us to survive, but we still believe in the principle. So I can understand why a person like Joseph Musser would, on the one hand, be disfellowshipped, and on the other hand, say, okay, you know, we get why you did it. You can't do that anymore, but we still want you to be part of the gospel kingdom. So I was just going to wrap things up saying that polygamy did endure unofficially probably for another 15, maybe 20 years after the so-called Second Manifesto of 1904.
I think I want to end on this question. This is from Jill Henriksen. Let's do a silly one. This is from the guys over at Mormon Studies. It says, is it documented how many times Surrender Dorothy has been spray painted on the freeway overpass by the D.C. Temple?
I have no idea, but I loved that question so much. The background of that question is basically, you know, when you're in D.C. and you're driving up to the temple, it looks an awful lot like the Wizard of Oz's, you know, grand castle. You know, there's a famous line in The Wizard of Oz. You know, it was sketched in smoke from the witch's broom, saying, you know, "Surrender, Dorothy." So as you're approaching, you know, this Oz-like castle, you're thinking, it's like, huh, this looks an awful lot like The Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody thought it would be really funny to, you know, write the word "Surrender, Dorothy" on the overpass. So great question. I have no idea.
What? There's no historical documentation of that? Come on.
Next time I'm at the Church History Archives, I will type the word "Surrender Dorothy" into the catalog and see what comes up.
All right, let's wrap out on this. This is from Jill Henriksen, and it's a bunch of questions. So let's just go one by one. Do you feel that the Church glosses over some of the not-so-flattering history?
So I'm going to play a bit of a semantics game, and I do that because I actually do believe that the meanings of words are important. I would say this, it's really important that we have proper definitions here. When we say the Church, does she mean Church leadership? Does she mean President Monson? Does she mean the Church History Library? And I say that because, depending on who you ask, you'll probably get different answers.
Okay.
Right? I had the opportunity of working at the Church History Archives for a year, and I developed close relationships with some of the historians there, men like Matthew Groh, or men that were collaborating with the Church History Library, men like Stephen Harper. And these are men who are committed to understanding the truth in all of its nuance. For those individuals who have purchased volumes of the Joseph Smith Papers, you'll get to see examples of this. In the volume that discusses polygamy in some depth, you see accounts in there that Latter-day Saints have never even, many Latter-day Saints aren't even familiar with to this day. And these volumes were approved by top-level church leaders. So she asks the question, does the Church gloss over uncomfortable aspects of its history? Well, I would say, it depends on, which member of the Church are you talking about? Which church leader are you talking about? Men like Elder Holland or men like Elder Jensen, both of them have been fantastic at grappling with, some of the parts of our history that don't quite fit into with the narrative that we've been raised with.
Mm-hmm.
So my experience has been overwhelmingly positive on that front. I did not meet a single historian in the Church History Archives that was really of the sort to dismiss aspects of their history. They grappled with it. They had a faithful take on it. They viewed it through a faithful lens.
Mm-hmm.
But that isn't the same thing as ignoring our history.
Do you think it's also a sort of an element of, because when I think about that, or when I first read that question, my mind kind of went to this idea, and I don't mean to dismiss the question, but the idea of, there are a lot of things that, you could either find to agree or disagree with, but I guess my mind goes to, man, I'm having a hard enough time just, really focusing on treating people well and getting my
right.
butt to church. You know what I'm saying? And I know
sure.
that kind of downplays people's questions where it's like, yeah, but you're not answering the history question or anything like that. Do you feel like maybe as a whole of the church, or doctrinally as the church, or, curriculum curriculum as the church goes. It's kind of one of those milk before meat kind of things where it's like, let's get everybody on this page and
yeah,
then have
yeah.
this available.
And I can really appreciate that approach, at least on its own terms. Now, I have had conversations with individuals where, you know, like you, they say, you know, I really want to focus on, you know, being a kind person and, you know, helping the Joneses move to another home. Typically, though, when I've had those conversations, these are often the people who have at one point had issues with historicity. You know, they went through their crucible and, you know, they found out, you know, various things that they just realized weren't true, and these things had played a formative part in their testimony as youth. So it seems like sometimes, as people begin to, you know, focus on practical religion, it's typically the product of some kind of crisis of faith when it comes to history.
Mm-hmm.
So I can definitely appreciate, you know, this sense of, okay, you know, let's teach people, you know, some degree of lived religion first, and then, you know, kind of let the historical issues take care of themselves. But, you know, another thing that comes to mind for me is, for some people, a narrative is very important. I mean, in fact, the church history narrative defines whether they're able to, you know, live according to the commandments of the gospel. Say, well, hey, listen, if Joseph Smith is off practicing polygamy, and he's practicing polyandry in some cases, why should I have to live the law of chastity?
Right.
Right? He obviously saw the law of chastity in a different way than I did, in a different way than a lot of Latter-day Saints do, so I feel like I should be able to see it in a different way as well. So I can sympathize with those members of the church who see the history, they see the ambiguity, and they say, well, wait, what are the practical consequences? And for a lot of people, they could be significant.
Let's go back a little bit further on the question here. Picking it back up, it says, do you feel the church glosses over some of the not-so-flattering history? I do feel that they do, but at the same time, the haters want to nitpick everything. Should the church, in your honest opinion, be more forthcoming with history?
Well, I think I spoke to that somewhat with the earlier answer. I think, especially with the Joseph Smith Papers Project, the Mountain Meadows Massacre book that came out a few years ago, and various other projects, I would say that the Church History Department is doing a very good job of, you know, making the material available to Latter-day Saints. And if you go to the Joseph Smith Papers website, that's extremely accessible.
What's the website?
You basically have, it's josephsmithpapers.org.
Okay.
And on that website, you have a treasure trove of documentation relating to Joseph Smith's life and, you know, his relationship with Emma and his relationship with other leaders of the church. And it does touch on, you know, on issues that could be problematic to many Latter-day Saints. So I do see really positive things happening, at least coming from the Church History Library. Now, that being said, I don't know this woman, so I can't speak to her experience, but if her experience has been anything like my own personal experience, you tend to see, you know, more stonewalling on the local level in one's intimate circles. You know, you're at a party of some kind, and, you know, you make a comment about, you know, one of these problematic issues. And maybe I'm the only kind of person who would do this sort of thing at a party, but I am.
Yeah, what kind of party is this?
and individuals will look at you and they'll just go quiet. And they'll go silent and say, man, you know, what is he talking about? Like, is it okay? Is he one of those antis? So instead of asking, is what this person is saying true, they're asking, is this person my friend or are they my foe? Mm-hmm. Are they for the church or are they against the church? So if that's what she's talking about, I can definitely sympathize with that. And, you know, Jonathan Haidt, who is a fairly prominent social psychologist, he's argued that this sort of mental process is hardwired into us. You know, when we meet somebody, the questions that go through our mind aren't, okay, are they speaking the truth? Are they giving me good ideas? Are they, you know, are they enlightening? But rather, are they with me or are they against me?
Hmm.
So I think that's what she's talking about, and I have indeed experienced that, and it's unfortunate. And, you know, hopefully, you know, we as a Latter-day Saint community can fix that, and I think that we can as a people, as a community, and as we do, then it will, you know, make the environment friendlier to this kind of conversation, you know, among the top leading figures of the church. I'm firm believer in that. But, you know, when we as a people repent and change, then it actually frees up the leader's hands to also, also engage us on those terms as well.
The last part of her question, I'll just read the whole thing out, but this is the last question for this.
Sure.
It says, one other thing. How come the curse of Cain is still in print when that has been refuted? Shouldn't McConkie's Mormon doctrine have a little have a title with a disclaimer more apparent on the cover, such as Mormon Doctrine According to Bruce R. McConkie? The title is quite misleading otherwise. These are just some of the sticking points with me.
That's a fascinating question, and I actually just went to a presentation by Dr. Matthew Harris on this of Colorado State. You know, he was talking about racial reconciliation in the Mormon tradition. So the history of Mormon doctrine in and of itself is a story to be told. In the very first edition of it, he did indeed include a proviso saying that these views were his own and were not necessarily representative of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And that was a rather remarkable admission for the time. So we need to give him some credit for that. But she's right that the curse of Cain doctrine endured in the Mormon Doctrine volume, you know, for several years. Now, a few years ago, though, Deseret Book did indeed declare that they would no longer sell the volume or even publish the volume due to low sales.
Oh, really?
You know, that is what they publicly declared. I haven't gone and searched for Mormon Doctrine volume, so it's entirely possible that a few copies have, you know, made it out here and there. I doubt that, but I'm not going to say it isn't possible. So to answer her question, there have been some measures taken. But you know, for those who, you know, believe in this deeply, and I count myself among them, you can say, well, you know, we need to work even harder, because I know from personal experience that mythology about the curse of Cain doctrine continues to endure among the Latter-day Saint people. You know, Jeffrey R. Holland, he explicitly denounced, you know, old folklorish explanations for the priesthood ban in his interview with Helen Whitney on that Mormons documentary. Mm-hmm. It was produced on PBS a couple years back. So we need to make sure that we refuse to accept that doctrine anymore. You know, whether or not volumes of Mormon doctrine are still being circulated, whether or not they're still being cited in talks, that matters less than that we listen to what the brethren are saying now. And frankly, I mean, when it comes to the issues of the priesthood doctrine, you know, we can go even further than that. You know, we can, you know, offer some level of certainty, at least as to when it took place. And we can speculate in an informed way as to why it took place. But at the very least, we can, you know, look to people like Jeffrey R. Holland and say, listen, whatever was said in the past, it's over now. Bruce R. McConkie said that himself. In 1978, he said, forget everything I've said. We got it wrong, essentially. He didn't say we got it wrong, but he essentially communicated that message in 1978. So I think that we as a people need to come to grips with our racist past, and I use the word racist in an informed way, understanding that it can be a charged term, but it is applicable. Mm-hmm. We can do this, and we can do it in a way to where we don't need to throw Bruce R. McConkie under the bus. We don't need to throw the church under the bus. We just recognize that this was a collective sin. This was something that we all got wrong, and it's something that we can all get right.
Russell, there's this last comment on this post that you left, The Cultural Hall on Facebook. It's facebook.com/The Cultural Hall, wherein John Shaw, I think he's a convert to the Cultural Hall from Missouri, I want to say. Forgive me, John, if mm-hmm. I got that wrong. He says, man, this could be one of the better episodes, or it could be one of the worst. Good luck. And so I feel like, I feel like we did a good job, and I appreciate you being educated on these various questions and then delivering it, of course, in your opinion and based on the things that you've been able to.
Yeah, and I'm glad you included that proviso, Richie, because, you know, any scholar you talk to, like, we're all doing our best to figure out what it's all about. And, you know, we're trying, most scholars I know are trying to give you an honest assessment. That doesn't mean that they'll always be right or that, you know, that they will leave no stone unturned. We probably will. But most scholars aren't trying to deceive you. They just want to, you know, understand how things happen in the messiest in all of its messy glory, right? In all of its raw truth.
You want to do this again in the future?
It's been my pleasure, Richie. You can call me anytime.
All right, check it out. You can follow his interesting Mormon facts of the day by going to our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/theculturalhall. Like it there, or you can go to mormonhistoryguide.com. You can get his longer essays, dissertations, his musings. What would you call it?
All of the above.
Thanks for being agreeable. I hope that this podcast has nourished and strengthened your body. Let me say this actually before I wrap this out. We're going to have you on again. And if people want to send questions, right before we have you on again, we'll do another Facebook post where people can ask questions. But if you have questions in the meantime, you can send them to richie@theculturalhall.com or the contact us at theculturalhall.com. And I'll hang on to those questions. And when we get a good amount of questions together, we'll do another episode and put it out there. Now, hope that this podcast has nourished and strengthened your body, and that if you weren't healthy enough to listen this week, you will be healthy enough to listen next week. In the meantime, Russell, we'll be saving a seat for you on the back row of the Cultural Hall.
It's the best place to be.
Save me a seat. It's sure to be neat.